The church smelled of beeswax and lilies, and Beatrice Vane was trying very hard not to sneeze. It was her sister's wedding, a fact she reminded herself of as she stood at the register table with the quill in her hand and the vicar's patience visibly thinning. Her sister Rosalind was radiant in white muslin with seed pearls at the bodice, her hand resting lightly on the arm of Mr. Dent. Philip Asquith, a pleasant man of moderate fortune, whom Beatrice had met precisely twice before this morning, and who was at this moment watching the chapel door rather than his bride. The second witness, Mr. Asquith's groomsman, a Mr. Collier, was late. The vicar had been clear that the register required two witnesses, and the register would not close until two witnesses had signed. Beatrice could hear the congregation shifting behind her. 60 guests, a late April morning, bright sunlight through plain glass windows, and the particular restless energy of people who had dressed carefully for an occasion that was now running 17 minutes behind schedule. Her father, seated in the second pew with his hands folded over his walking stick, had the expression of a man who was composing a letter of complaint to someone and had not yet decided whom. The door opened. The man who entered was not Mr. Grah. Collier. He was taller, broader across the shoulders, wearing a dark traveling coat still damp at the hem, and he had the particular look of someone who had ridden hard through the night and arrived at precisely the wrong moment. He stood in the doorway, taking in the scene. The altar flowers, the waiting congregation, the vicar's thunderous expression, and Beatrice watched him process the situation with the rapid calculation of a man accustomed to walking into rooms and understanding them quickly. The vicar did not wait for introductions. He thrust the register across the table, pointed to the witness line, and said, with the compressed fury of a clergyman who had been promised the ceremony would take 40 minutes and was now approaching an hour, "Sign there." The man signed Beatrice, who had been holding the quill for so long her fingers had cramped around it, looked down at the register and wrote her name in the line the vicar indicated. The vicar closed the register. He turned to the congregation. He said the words. Beatrice felt the cold arrive first in her fingertips and then spread upward through her wrists and into the cavity of her chest. She was looking at the register. The vicar had closed it, but the ink was still wet and the blotting sand had not been applied, and she could see, through the edge of the page, the shape of what she had written. She had signed her own name. Her full legal name, Beatrice Eloise Vane, in the line that required the bride's signature, not the witness line. Not the space the vicar had pointed to, or rather, the space the vicar had pointed to, which she had taken to be the witness line, which was, in fact, the marriage line. Because the register had been turned sideways to accommodate the late arrival, and the vicar had been pointing with the frustrated imprecision of a man who wanted the entire business concluded. She had signed the marriage line, not as a witness, as a bride. She looked up. The man beside her, the stranger who had walked through the door 12 minutes ago, was reading what she had written. His finger rested on the page beside her signature. He looked at her. She looked at him. Neither of them spoke. The vicar, who had already turned to the congregation, pronounced the marriage valid and blessed. The silence that followed was not the reverent silence of a congregation moved by the solemnity of matrimony. It was the bewildered silence of 60 people who could see from the expressions of the two individuals standing at the register that something had gone profoundly and irreversibly wrong. Rosalind was the first to speak. "Be," she said, in the careful tone of an older sister who has spent 23 years interpreting her younger sister's silences. "What have you done?" "I believe," Beatrice said, and her voice was remarkably steady for a woman whose hands had gone entirely numb. "I have married this gentleman." The gentleman in question looked at her. He looked at the register. He looked at the vicar, who had gone the color of whey. "George Hartwell," he said, "Duke of Meryton." He paused. "I came for my cousin's wedding." "This is not your cousin's wedding," Beatrice said. "No," the Duke agreed. "Apparently it is mine." The next 90 minutes were, by any reasonable measure, the worst of Beatrice's life, and she had once been thrown from a pony into a mill pond in front of the entire village. Her father was summoned from the pew. The vicar was persuaded not to faint. Rosalind's actual wedding was completed. Mr. Jew. Collier, having arrived at last, soaked in mud and full of apologies about a thrown shoe on the Guildford Road, and the congregation was asked, with the particular diplomacy of a country vicar in crisis, to proceed to the wedding breakfast while the matter of the register was examined. The matter of the register was examined in the vestry by Beatrice's father, the vicar, the Duke, and Beatrice herself. The Duke's traveling coat had been removed, and he stood in a dark blue tailcoat with road dust on his boots, looking at the document with the expression of a man who has walked through the wrong door and found himself in a country he does not recognize. "The entry is clear," Mr. Vane said. He was a solicitor by profession, a careful man by temperament, and he was reading the register with the particular intensity of someone examining a document that had just made his youngest daughter a duchess, both signatures present. Both parties present before a clergyman. The marriage act is explicit. "It was an error," the Duke said. His voice was calm. Beatrice noted that his calm, like hers, had the quality of a thing being maintained rather than a thing that existed naturally. "Undoubtedly," Mr. Vane replied. "But an error in the register, once signed and witnessed and pronounced upon by an ordained clergyman, is not, the law is unfortunately clear on this point, automatically void. The marriage is, until an ecclesiastical court rules otherwise, legally binding." The Duke looked at Beatrice. She met his gaze steadily. She had been expecting this, not in the sense that she had predicted the morning's catastrophe, but in the sense that she knew the law as well as her father did, possibly better because she had spent 17 years reading his case files when she was supposed to be doing needlework. She knew that a marriage, solemnized before a clergyman, with signatures of both parties, was not a thing that could be undone with an apology and a fresh page. "How long?" the Duke said, with the annulment tick.
"6 months, Mr. Prate." Vane said, "Perhaps longer."
The ecclesiastical courts are not swift, and the grounds, error of identity, absence of intent, are sound, but would require testimony, documentation, and a degree of public examination that would be, he looked at his daughter, considerable. "Considerable meaning the entire county would know," Beatrice said.
"Considerable meaning the entire country," her father corrected. "A duke's marriage is not a private matter, even when it is an accident."
The silence that followed this observation had the weight of something settling into place. Beatrice watched the Duke process the information. He did not bluster. He did not pace. He stood very still, looking at the register, and she saw his mind working through the same calculations hers had already completed. The timeline, the cost, the scandal, the inevitability. He arrived at the conclusion she had reached 9 minutes earlier. "Then we are married," he said.
"For the present," Beatrice said.
"Yes, the present," it emerged, "would require certain arrangements." The Duke could not return to his estate in Herefordshire with an accidental wife in tow. Or, rather, he could. But the logistics of housing a woman he had met an hour ago in his ancestral home raised questions of propriety that neither of them was prepared to address. Instead, by mutual agreement and with the particular awkwardness of two rational people attempting to be sensible about an irrational situation, Beatrice remained at her father's house in Surrey while the Duke's solicitor was summoned. The solicitor, a Mr. Pruitt, arrived the following morning. He was a thin man with spectacles and the expression of someone who had built a career on the assumption that the aristocracy would continue to surprise him and had just been proven comprehensively right.
"The marriage is legal, Mr.
Pruitt said, after examining the register, the vicar's testimony, and Beatrice's account of the morning. "I have seen a great many unusual circumstances in 30 years of practice, and I confess this is among the more remarkable. The question is not whether the marriage is valid, it is, but what you wish to do about it." What Beatrice wished to do about it was pursue the annulment cleanly, efficiently,
and with the minimum of public attention. She said so. The Duke, who was sitting across the table from her in her father's study, a room that smelled of leather and ink and the particular dusty warmth of a solicitor's working life, agreed. They were in complete accord. They were in complete accord for approximately 4 days. The difficulty was not legal but practical. The annulment required both parties to testify, separately and in detail, about the circumstances of the marriage. It required witnesses, the vicar, Mr. Collier, Rosalind, Mr. Asquith. It required a formal petition to the ecclesiastical court, which would not sit until Michaelmas term, and, in the interim, the marriage was legally and socially a fact. The Duke's household would know. The ton would know. Lady Hartwell, the Duke's aunt, a formidable woman who considered herself the guardian of the Hartwell family reputation, already knew, because news of this nature traveled faster than any mail coach. Lady Hartwell's letter arrived on the third day. Beatrice did not read it. It was addressed to the Duke, but she observed its effect. The Duke read it at breakfast, folded it precisely, and set it beside his plate with the care of a man placing something dangerous at a safe distance. "My aunt," he said, "has engaged her own solicitor to pursue the annulment. To pursue the annulment, regardless of what either of us decides." Beatrice set down her teacup. "That is not her decision to make." "No," the Duke agreed. "It is not." He looked at her across the breakfast table, her father's breakfast table, where she had eaten every morning of her life, which was now occupied by a Duke she had accidentally married, who was eating toast with the careful deliberation of a man thinking about something else entirely. "Miss Vane, Mrs. has." "Yes, Hartwell," she corrected, and then stopped, because the name had come out of her mouth before she had decided to say it, and the expression on his face suggested he had not expected to hear it, and she had not expected the way it sounded when she said it. Not wrong, precisely, but startling, like finding a door where she had expected a wall. "Mrs. Hartwell," he said. The correction sat between them on the table. The days that followed established a pattern that neither of them had planned, and both of them maintained, with the particular discipline of people who have agreed to be practical. The Duke remained at Mr. Dill Vane's house. The impropriety of his departure would have been greater than the impropriety of his presence, a calculation Beatrice's father had made with characteristic precision. They breakfasted together. They consulted Mr. Pride, Pruitt together. They walked in the garden when the weather was fine, because the house was not large enough for two people who were trying to occupy separate rooms and kept encountering each other in hallways. It was in the garden, on the fifth day, that Beatrice began to notice the difficulty. The difficulty was not that the Duke was unpleasant. The difficulty was that he was not. He was intelligent, direct, and possessed of a dry wit that surfaced unexpectedly and made her laugh before she could prevent it. He listened when she spoke, not with the performative attention of a man being polite, but with the genuine focus of someone who found what she said interesting. He asked her about her father's practice. He asked her about the books on her shelf. He held doors for her, not with the exaggerated gallantry of a man performing courtesy, but with the unconscious ease of someone who had noticed she was there and adjusted accordingly, which was, she had observed over 26 years of existing in rooms with men, considerably rarer. On the fourth morning, he had come into the study to find her reading a brief her father had left on the desk, a property dispute involving a contested boundary wall in Hampshire, and instead of asking why a woman was reading legal documents at 7 o'clock in the morning, he had sat down across from her and asked what she thought of the claimant's argument. She had told him. It was not a short answer. He had not interrupted. On the fifth morning, in the garden, she was explaining the difference between common law precedent and equity jurisdiction, a distinction her father considered fundamental and most people considered incomprehensible. And the Duke said, "You mean that the law says one thing and justice requires another? And the courts have built an entire parallel system to manage the gap." She stopped walking. "Yes," she said. That is exactly what I mean. It seems inefficient. It is spectacularly inefficient. My father has made his entire career on the inefficiency. He laughed. It was the first time she had heard him laugh properly, not the controlled amusement of a man in a difficult situation maintaining good humor, but the genuine startled sound of someone who had been caught off guard by delight. She filed the sound away in the part of her mind that was supposed to be cataloging reasons to pursue the annulment, and was instead, she was beginning to suspect, building a case for the opposition. He asked her on the sixth morning what she thought of the annulment petition Mr. Pruitt had drafted, and when she identified 3 points of procedural weakness, the citation of Fletcher v. Marchmont was from King's Bench, not the ecclesiastical courts. The grounds omitted the question of parochial jurisdiction, and the attestation clause was missing a required signature line. He looked at her with an expression she could not immediately classify, and said, "You should have been a solicitor." "I should have been many things," she said. "The law does not accommodate most of them." He did not argue. He did not offer empty reassurance. He did not say that the world was changing, or that exceptions could be made, or any of the comfortable nothings that people offered when confronted with a constraint they had no intention of addressing. He looked at her as if he were seeing something he had not expected to find, and she recognized the look, because she was wearing it herself. On the seventh day he brought her a book from the lending library in the village, a volume of Blackstone's commentaries that she already owned, but in an edition she did not, with marginalia from a previous owner who had disagreed with Blackstone on the question of coverture and said so in handwriting almost as sharp as Beatrice's own. She read the marginalia at the breakfast table while the Duke ate his toast and pretended not to watch her smile. By the end of the first week, they had stopped discussing the annulment at breakfast. By the end of the second, they had stopped discussing it at dinner. The petition sat on Mr. Pruitt's desk, unsigned. Mr. Vane observed the situation with the expression of a man who had spent his career watching people arrive at conclusions they were not yet ready to articulate. Lady Hartwell arrived on the 15th day. She came in a carriage, with her own solicitor, a pinched man named Mr. Ferris, and the particular energy of a woman who had traveled 60 miles to correct a mistake that no one had asked her to correct. She was shown into the drawing room where Beatrice was reading and the Duke was writing letters, and she stood in the doorway, taking in the scene. The two of them, the shared room, the easy proximity, with an expression that suggested she had expected to find a crisis and had instead found something worse. Domesticity. "George," Lady Hartwell said, "this situation cannot continue." "Good morning, Aunt." "The petition must be filed. Mr. Ferris has prepared the documents. The grounds are unassailable error. Absence of intent, no consummation." She said the last word with the particular precision of a woman who had decided that delicacy was a luxury the situation could not afford. "This can be resolved quietly, if it is resolved quickly." "And if I do not wish to resolve it quickly?" the Duke said. The silence that followed had the quality of something cracking. Lady Hartwell looked at her nephew. She looked at Beatrice. She looked back at her nephew with the expression of a woman who is revising her understanding of the situation in real time and did not care for the revision. "You could not mean to remain married to a woman you met by accident in a church vestry." "I met her at the altar," the Duke said, "which is, I believe, the traditional location." Lady Hartwell did not find this amusing. She remained for 3 days, during which she made her position clear at every opportunity, at meals, in the garden, in the drawing room, in whispered conferences with Mr. Dest. Ferris that Beatrice could hear through the study wall, because the house was built in the previous century, and the walls were not thick. Her argument was consistent. The marriage was an embarrassment. The girl was nobody. The family name required protection. Beatrice said nothing. She continued to read. She continued to walk in the garden. She continued to breakfast with the Duke, who continued to ask her opinion about things and listen to her answers and look at her with that expression she had now classified as recognition, the particular look of a person who is found in entirely the wrong circumstances, exactly the right thing. On the third evening, Lady Hartwell cornered Beatrice in the hallway outside the dining room. "You must see," Lady Hartwell said, "that this is untenable. You are a solicitor's daughter. He is a duke. The distance between those positions is not bridged by a clerical error." Beatrice looked at her. She had her father's composure, not the performed stillness of a woman suppressing emotion, but the genuine steadiness of someone who had been taught from childhood to examine a situation before responding to it. "You are correct," Beatrice said. "The distance is considerable. I have not asked him to bridge it." "Then you will sign the petition." "I will sign what I choose to sign," Beatrice said. "I have already demonstrated what happens when I sign things without sufficient care." She delivered this observation without a smile and walked into the dining room, where the Duke was standing at the window with a glass of wine and the particular expression of a man who has just overheard something through a thin wall and is trying to decide whether to mention it. He did not mention it. He pulled out her chair. She sat. Lady Hartwell left the following morning. What remained in her absence was the question she had accidentally clarified. If someone was actively working to undo this marriage, what did they actually want? Beatrice knew what she was supposed to want. She was supposed to want the annulment, the clean resolution, the return to her father's house, the restoration of her life to the shape it had occupied before a late groomsman and an impatient vicar had rearranged it. She was supposed to want her own name back, her own prospects, her own future uncomplicated by the legal consequences of poor penmanship. She sat in the garden on the 17th day and thought about what she actually wanted, which was more complicated and less convenient and involved a man who brought her books about property law and listened when she explained equity, jurisdiction, and laughed, properly laughed, the startled warm sound that she had catalogued and kept when she said something clever. The Duke, she had learned in 17 days, was not a man who had avoided marriage. He had attempted it once, a Miss Elliston, the daughter of a baronet, a perfectly suitable match arranged by perfectly suitable families. The engagement had lasted 4 months and dissolved through no one's fault. Miss Elliston had realized, with admirable honesty, that she did not love him, and he had realized with less admirable delay that he had not minded her realization as much as a man in love should have. They had parted civilly. She had married a naval captain the following year and was, by all accounts, happy. The Duke had returned to his estate and his books and his seat in the House of Lords and the particular solitude of a man who had tried the expected thing and found it insufficient, but did not know what the unexpected thing looked like. He was beginning to suspect it looked like a solicitor's daughter with sharp handwriting and a sharper mind who had walked into his life through a clerical error and refused to be diminished by the absurdity of how she had arrived. The Duke asked Beatrice to walk with him on the 18th day. It was a bright morning, late April, tipping into May, the garden in full blossom, the particular golden light of an English spring that makes everything look like a painting one cannot quite afford. They walked in silence for several minutes, which was unusual. They had become over 18 days of enforced proximity, people who talked easily and often about law and books and the particular absurdities of their situation. The silence meant he was composing something. "I should like," the Duke said, "to ask you a question. But I find I cannot ask it without first telling you something, and I cannot tell you the thing without risking the answer to the question, which presents a difficulty." "You are a duke," Beatrice said. "Difficulties are, I understand, part of the position. The thing I wish to tell you," he said, "is that I no longer want the annulment." She stopped walking. The garden was very quiet. "Why?" "I gar. A blackbird was singing somewhere in the hedge, and the roses along the south wall were in their first bloom, and the morning light was falling across his face in a way that made him look both younger and more serious than she had yet seen him. The question I wish to ask," he continued, "is whether you would consider, not as a matter of legal convenience, not as a resolution to an administrative error, not because my aunt is engaged in a campaign of interference, whether you would consider remaining married to me. Deliberately. By choice, Beatrice looked at him. She thought of the register. She thought of the quill in her hand, the vicar's impatient finger, the moment she had written her name in the wrong line and changed the course of both their lives. She thought of 18 mornings across a breakfast table, learning the particular way he held his teacup, and the sound of his laugh, and the expression he wore when he was thinking about something that mattered to him, which was the expression he was wearing now. Sal, was, tska, and the ves. I will consider it, she said. Ask me again when you are certain. I am certain now. Then ask me again when I am. He waited. She made him wait 3 days. Not because she was uncertain. She had known since the 12th day, since the morning he had read her father's case notes over her shoulder and said quite seriously that the precedent she had identified was stronger than the one Mr. Pruitt had cited, and she had looked up at him and thought, with the particular clarity of a woman who pays attention, oh, there you are. But certainty and readiness are different things, and she wanted to be both. Poor. On the 21st day, 3 weeks, since a stranger had walked through a church door and signed his name beside hers, Rosalind's first gathering as a married woman took place at her new home. The ton was present, or enough of it to constitute an audience. Everyone knew the story. Opinions were divided between those who found the accidental duchess a figure of comedy and those who found her a figure of sympathy, and a smaller contingent who found the entire situation rather romantic and would not say so in public. Lady Hartwell was there. She had not been invited. She had come anyway, with Mr. Ferris and the unsigned petition and the particular determination of a woman who had decided that her nephew's happiness was less important than his dignity, without pausing to consider that they might be the same thing. Beatrice arrived on the Duke's arm. She wore a gown of pale blue silk, the first garment she had owned that was not made by a local seamstress, and she walked into the room as if she had been walking into rooms on the arm of a duke her entire life, which she had not. But composure is composure, regardless of its history. The room watched. The room always watches. Lady Hartwell spoke first, as Beatrice had known she would. She addressed the room, rather than the couple, a remark made to the Countess of Hayford, but pitched to carry about the annulment proceedings, and the family's expectations, and the unfortunate situation that would of course be resolved before the season's end. The Duke stopped walking. Beatrice felt his arm tense beneath her hand, and then deliberately relax, and she knew, with the particular knowledge of a woman who had spent 3 weeks learning the language of a man's silences, that what he was about to say was not improvised. He had been waiting for this Lady Hayford, he said, and his voice carried because he intended it to. May I present my wife, the Duchess of Meryton? The room went very still, not silent. There were 60 people holding glasses and opinions, and the particular English inability to be quiet when something interesting was happening. But still, in the way that a room becomes still when it recognizes that it is witnessing something that will be discussed for the rest of the season. He turned to Beatrice. The room was watching. Lady Hartwell was watching. Mr. Ferris was watching, with the expression of a man who could see his fee disappearing. I have asked you once, the Duke said, and his voice was quieter now. Not private, not in a room of 60, but directed, meant for her, heard by everyone. I am asking again, will you give me the chance to make this intentional? Beatrice looked at him. She thought of the register. She thought of the quill. She thought of 21 days and a breakfast table and a garden in spring and the way he listened when she spoke and the way he looked at her when she said something clever, which was often and the particular extraordinary absurdity of a life that had handed her, through clerical error and a late groomsman and a vicar's impatient finger, the precise thing she had not known she wanted. She made him wait. Not long. 5 heartbeats, perhaps 6. Long enough for the room to hold its breath and Lady Hartwell to grip her fan, and Rosalind, in the corner, to press her hand to her mouth. "Yes," Beatrice said, "though I should like it noted that I am signing nothing today." The Duke laughed. It was not a polished laugh, not the measured amusement of a man performing for a room. It was sudden and real and warm, and the room heard it and revised its opinion of the accidental Duchess from comedy to something considerably more interesting. The annulment petition was never signed. Mr. Ferris was paid for his trouble and sent back to London. Lady Hartwell adjusted, not gracefully, not quickly, but with the particular resignation of a woman who has lost a battle she should not have fought. The Duke told her once, in his study, that he would manage his own marriage, and that she was not invited to form an opinion on it again. She formed opinions, because she was Lady Hartwell, and opinions were her principal occupation, but she kept them to herself, which was, for her, an act of considerable restraint. The marriage was conducted properly in every sense except the first 30 seconds. Beatrice moved to Hertfordshire in June, when the gardens at Merton Park were at their finest, and the house, a sprawling Palladian affair, with more rooms than any two people could reasonably occupy, stood golden in the long summer light. She arrived with 3 trunks, her father's annotated copy of Blackstone, and the particular composure of a woman who had decided that if she was going to be a duchess, she would be a thorough one. Mrs. Grove, the housekeeper, met her at the door. She was a solid woman, with capable hands, and the expression of someone who had managed this household through the old Duke's final years, the young Duke's solitary ones, and the arrival of an accidental duchess, and intended to manage it through whatever came next. She took Beatrice through the house, room by room, the morning room, with its south-facing windows, the library with its 12-foot ceilings, and the particular smell of old leather and beeswax, the kitchens where the cook had been told to expect a duchess, and had prepared accordingly, the bedchambers that had been aired and furnished and made ready with the careful attention of a staff that understood what this arrival meant. The East Wing, Mrs. Grove said, pausing at a set of double doors, has not been opened in 3 years. His Grace did not see the purpose. Open it, Beatrice said. Air it. I will need a study. Mrs. Grove looked at her. It was the look of a woman revising her expectations upward. Yes. Your Grace, Mr. Sands. Sabin the steward was a quiet man, who kept meticulous accounts, and had managed the estate with the competence of someone who expected no interference and would tolerate no negligence. Beatrice did not interfere. She read his quarterly reports, asked precise questions about the tenant leases and the drainage improvements he had proposed for the North Fields, and suggested, not directed, suggested, that the cottages on the western boundary might benefit from the same roof repairs that had been completed on the eastern ones the previous autumn. Mr. Sabin, who had not been asked for his opinion of the new Duchess, would have said, if pressed, that she was the most useful thing to happen to the estate since the installation of the new well pump. The tenants took longer, but arrived at the same conclusion. The household which had expected a duchess and received an accident, discovered that an accident could be, if the accident in question was Beatrice Vane, rather formidable. The Duke, George, as she had learned to call him, first in private, and then without thinking, which is the only way a name becomes real, sat in the House of Lords when the session required it, and came home to a house that was, for the first time in his memory, a place he wanted to return to. He had not expected to find the life he wanted through a misread register and a woman who signed her name in the wrong line. But expectations, he had learned, were a poor guide to the actual shape of a life. Years passed. 2 children arrived, a daughter first, then a son, both with their mother's dark eyes and their mother's handwriting, which was impeccable because Beatrice had made certain of it. She had engaged a writing master before the eldest could hold a quill, and she supervised every lesson with the particular vigilance of a woman who understood from personal experience the consequences of penmanship. The original marriage register remained in the parish church in Surrey. Mystery. Vane visited it once a year on the anniversary, and examined the entry with the careful attention of a solicitor reviewing the most interesting document of his career. He had told Beatrice, more than once, that he intended to cite it in his memoirs. She had told him, more than once, that he did not have memoirs. He had begun writing them anyway. The Duke had a copy made, not a legal copy. A decorative one, hand-lettered by a calligrapher who had been told the story and had laughed so hard he had to put down his pen twice. It hung in the study at Meryton Park, framed in gilt, between a portrait of the Duke's grandfather and a watercolor of the South Garden that Beatrice had painted the first summer, and which was, if one were being honest, not very good. Beatrice had told him, several times, to take it down. He had not taken it down. She had stopped telling him to. On fine mornings when the children were in the garden and the house was quiet and a light came through the study windows in that particular golden way that made the room look like something from a painting, she would stand in front of the framed register and read her own name. Beatrice Eloise Vane, written in a hand that was, despite what anyone said, perfectly legible. And think about a spring morning in a country church, when she had picked up a quill and signed her name in the wrong line and changed everything. She would not have unsigned it for the world. They arrive here, like a name written in the right place, after all, whenever they are ready.